I'm Elizabeth Jackson, and this is a Radio Current Affairs documentary. Tens of thousands of Cambodians fled the Khmer Rouge regime of the 1970s and ended up in refugee camps on the Thai border. Some of those families were resettled in the United States, and their children were raised as Americans, often with little connection to their homeland. A small number of young Cambodian Americans find themselves in trouble with the law, drugs and gang violence mostly, and their convictions earn them a one-way ticket to a country many have never known. For many, it's the first time they realise they're not full citizens of America, despite their parents being granted asylum and permanent residency. More than 200 people have been deported to Cambodia under this scheme since it began in 2003, and an estimated 2,000 more await a similar fate. In Phnom Penh, Radio Australia's Liam Cochrane met up with one of those deportees, Kasal Kiev, and spoke to him about his childhood alienation and his long stretch in tough US prisons, where he discovered the spoken word poetry that's helped him turn his life around.
And if the world is black and white, then let me bring the colours.
My name is Kasal Kiev. I'm 31 years old.
Kasal, tell me about your early life. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Santa Ana, Mini Street. When we first came here, we was in North Carolina through a sponsorship, church sponsorship. And from there, we didn't know any other Cambodians. There was no other Cambodians. So I guess I was only a year old, of course, right?
And this is, you were born whereabouts?
I was born in a Thai refugee camp in the border of Thailand and Cambodia in Kawadang. Yeah, so from there, we fled the refugee camp to North Carolina being sponsored. And when we got to North Carolina, there was no Cambodian as far as my mom told me and my sisters and brothers. So they went out to relatives out in Santa Ana, Mini Street in California. Now, that's where I grew up. It was the projects. You grow up and you realize you're different here. You know, goop, chink, tie-dye, you know, all these slurs, racial slurs, you somehow grew up knowing, understanding what they really meant. Now, at first, you're thinking, that's what they call you. But then you realize, no, it's a derogatory term. It was strange. It was weird, you know, because it was nine of us. We were living in a two-bedroom apartment, me, my mom, my grandmother, my three brothers, my three sisters. And my childhood, if I were to look back on it, was relatively okay. I mean, most of my family, they didn't know what to do. My mom was working three jobs. She was sewing. My grandmother was like in the backyard with this little backyard, and she's having her little garden, and she's growing her garden. I remember as a little kid, used to like walk with her door to door, because every time the garden would be ripe, she would pick it and stuff like that and put it in a basket, and we'd walk door to door trying to sell these vegetables.
How did that go down in modern American society?
It was pretty okay. It was cute because they couldn't say no to her because she was the old lady. And I was this little baby boy. And I'm the one that's handing the vegetables. So it's like, you know. So we got a lot of sales. We usually end up selling the whole batch and then coming home and trying to put food on the table and whatnot.
What did Cambodia mean to you as you grew up?
I didn't really know anything about it. You know, I knew that something bad happened. You know, but I really knew the whole extent of it. And then me growing up, everyone had their own issues, and I didn't realize that. You know, me growing up as in America, raised here and taught here, taught there, I didn't know that they had their own issues, that they were dealing of reintegration, they were dealing with culture shock and everything, and trying to educate themselves and all this stuff, when in actuality, I thought they didn't want me because I wasn't included in anything. So I'm like, okay, it's fine. So I started making my own friends. You know, so in a lot of ways, like, I know they're like excuses, and they're really sorry excuses for the choices that I made. But at that moment in time, I made them because of that.
Let's talk about those choices that you made, because your journey to Cambodia was as a result of your arrest in the States.
Yes.
Can you tell me about what happened?
So there was a group of guys, and one of the guys, he was like one of my best friends at that time, and he started having beef with some other guys, you know, because we're already in a gang, and they was already in the gang, and they were like, man, what's going on, man? Well, I don't know, man, these guys, you know, they're going to take us out, or we're going to take them out. No, it was just like a gang war. And I was just a straight soldier. That's all I was. I was a gunner. Hey, miner, go take care of this guy. I didn't care about living or dying. I didn't care about myself or anyone else for that matter. All I cared was about the family that I knew then, that came to become my family, and I would have done anything to protect them or to serve that purpose.
What did you do, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, we ended up in a shootout at a party, and I got caught like a week later or so for attempted murder. Nobody died. He got hit, but he didn't die. So they charged me with attempted murder. Actually, they charged me with 6 attempted murders because it was in a group setting. I fought it for 2 years thinking, okay, you know, they really didn't have no evidence. They really didn't have anything. But I was placed in the scene, you know. But then they did have one of my co-defendants, and he ended up turning state evidence later on down the line, saying yes, he was one of the shooters and stuff like that. So I ended up getting sentenced to 16 years. I got tried. Well, see, the thing was, I was trying to fight to get tried as a juvenile because I was 16. It was my first offense for anything. And I lost the fitness hearing, and they said, oh, no, you did adult crime. You're going to do adult time.
Can you tell me about your time in prison and what you did with that time and your experience of it?
Sure. 14 years. I remember in county jail, because, you know, you got to take steps to go to prison. County jail is where you're fighting your case and whatnot. And I said, I just caught my time. And we get shipped on a bus with a red orange jumpsuit, nothing underneath, with some flip-flops. Middle of the night on that Greyhound bus, you know. And we're riding through, and I have all these thoughts in mind, like, wow, this is really happening. You know, I'm going with the big boys. You know, I'm fresh 18 years old. You know, smaller than I am now, if you could imagine that. I remember getting there, and it was snowing. It was snowing. It was probably one of the first times I seen snow falling. I remember getting off of that bus, and we stopped in front of this big old machine. It felt like a machine, because it had these iron gates with barbed wires and the thing with the smoke coming out, one of them industrialized, you know, places. And I'm like, wow. This must be the beast that eats men's souls. And I remember that big old gate rumble just and opens up. Finally. Go in. The gate closes back. And you can look back and say, this is it. For the next 14 years, I won't see the outside.
Was it violent inside the prison?
It was violent. It was really violent, you know? I mean, this is how violent it is when you're able to learn how to make a knife that can pierce through skin with newspaper, soap, and wax.
What about your spoken word poetry? Did that begin in prison?
Yes, it began in prison, but then it was just writing. A year and a half later, I was shipped off to New Folsom State Prison. It was there when I met a group of poets, you can say. And it was by fluke. I was working PIA in the laundry, and it was like 3 guys. And they were like doing poetry. And I'm just listening. I stopped. They looked at me like, hey, you know, you write? You do poetry, you know? I'm like, yeah, I write. I write poetry. I'm like, oh, cool. I'm like, yeah, can I hear some more? They're like, yeah. So they start hearing some more and stuff like that. And they said, hey, you know, we hold a poetry class every Tuesday. Would you like to come? I'm like, yes, awesome, cool. And then there was this guy named Marty Williams. He was a war veteran. And he read his poetry. Oh, man. The way he read it, the cadences, the drops, the highs, the lows, the emotion, the life behind it. Beautiful. Never heard it before in my life. Like, yo, Marty, what is that right there, man? What is that? Because it's not rap. It's not. It's just. What is that? You're like, man, it's spoken word. Spoken word. Like, yeah. I'm like, how do you do that? He's like, well, you know, just bring life to the words. You know, some words just can't sit still on paper.
Yeah. See, I write for the essence of soul. For the old, cause experience is wisdom and wisdom is gold. Behold, I write for the gorillas and the Congos. For the nomads and the jungles following the rhythm of the bongos. Man, I write for the wars entrenching battle. Stretch out in the far corners of Burma, Malaysia, Cambodia, Afghan, Iran, Iraq, and deep Africa. Man, I write for the souls lost in Attica. I write for California, the golden state where we hold and wait. Struggling to hold on to faith cause they steady packing us in prisons till we old and gray. So I write for those in blue that's doing all day. Tehachapi, New Folsom, Corcoran, Pelican Bay, all the way to Susanville, High Desert and back down this way. Calipat, Lancaster, Soledad, Ironwood, and so many more, man, built in the cesspools. So I write about what's less cool. Yeah, let's think. So let's take a minute of silence and press pause. So let's take a minute of silence and press pause.
After you did your time, you were deported back to Cambodia.
Yes.
For people who've never heard of this, can you explain why you were, as a kid who grew up in the States, why you were sent back to Cambodia, or sent to Cambodia, not back?
Okay, so they said that because I committed a crime of immoral perpetuity, that it's reason to be deported. So if I didn't have my citizenship, which I couldn't have had my citizenship because I got locked up at 16. So how was I supposed to apply for my citizenship?
You were sent to Cambodia.
I was sent to Cambodia.
Tell me your first impressions upon arriving back.
I remember landing. I was so scared. I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I didn't know anyone here. All those dreams that I had when I was locked up, how am I going to accomplish them? What am I going to do? I know no language. I can speak it. I can understand it. But it's limited. I tried to take in the beauty of it and say, man, I'm free, though. You're free, though. You know? Whatever it is, you're free. Try to remember that. But it didn't even hit me because I was fortunate enough to where my sister and her husband and my nephew and niece came and picked me up. They flew out here to meet me out here. And I was fortunate of that. So when they came and picked me up, it felt like we were having a family vacation.
The difference being they could fly back and you couldn't.
Yeah, but it really didn't hit me until they did fly back and I couldn't. That how monumentous that was. And when they felt back, I felt really alone. That's when I really broke down. But that breaking down is familiar to me because I've had to do that many times in my life. Break myself down in order to pick myself back up. You know, rebuild myself. So I broke myself down and I stayed like that for maybe 2-3 days. Not doing anything, not caring and anything like that. But then I said, man, okay, now what? Are you just going to lay down? Or are you going to get back up?
So now we're less than a year on. Tell me about your life now in Phnom Penh.
In Phnom Penh. It's been amazing. I mean, the journey that I've gone through has been an amazing journey. I've been able to meet so many amazing people. From meeting Sakai had a mutual friend named Tia Sam. Tia Sam is an amazing person as well. And Tia Sam was the one that introduced me to Aneta and Masa.
They're the filmmakers, yes, who have turned this spoken word piece that we're featuring into a film clip.
Yes.
An amazing visual performance. Can you describe the video? What does it look like?
Okay, the video, it's on the road to the killing fields. I found it. It has rice fields in the background. It has just a dirt field with bricks in the background of like new house being built, but it's just a brick wall. But it's such an amazing, because when we got there, that day of the shoot, it was so many kids. It, just because it's the field, and I guess like all the neighborhood kids come there like during the sundown, and they're all out there. And I'm like, oh man, this is awesome, right? So I told them while they're setting up for the shoot and everything, look, I'm gonna go play with the kids, man. You know, I'll see y'all later. And the kids were running around chasing each other. And there's this little girl, like, yay high. She was so small. She was running. I'm like, I'm running like Eddie Munster. Ah! And she's like, ah! And then another girl, like, go pick, follow me, chase me, chase me. So I chased her, picked her up. I'm like, come on, let's chase the other kids. You know, we start chasing the other kids. It was just an amazing time.
And the video is yourself in what looks almost like a boxing ring, lit black and white, performing a piece called Why I Write. Tell me about the piece.
We wanted to make it look like a stage, and this is like my own stage that I'm building, creating. And in the background of the piece, you can hear, you know, if the world is black and white, then let me bring the colors. Anyone who felt alone, anyone who felt the sun. See, I write for the bones buried in the country I call home. And that right there is subject to like, yeah, I write for the, you can literally say that Cambodia or the States, because I buried bones in both places. For so long, Cambodia has been calling me back home as well. Has. It's unfortunate that I was able to be sent here the way I was, but in a way I find it a blessing as well, because Cambodia has been calling me. It called me when I was doing time and said, hey, come back.
Is it what you expected?
No, it's not at all what I expected at all. Cambodia has so many surprises, so much beauty. She's so resilient. Cambodia, I mean, to go what Cambodia has gone through and to be able to rise above that and say, you know what, we're not going anywhere. You know, you can try to extinguish us, you can try to exterminate the culture, the people, the language, but it's not going anywhere. We're here and we're gonna evolve, we're gonna change, we're gonna grow, you know. And when I saw that, the resilience of Cambodia, you know, that was afterwards, after the broken down part. And I said, you know what? Cambodia is resilient. And I'm resilient as well. You know, I survived. Cambodia survived. Now it's like two survivors that found each other.
Okay. That's enough. Let's get back to the cause. Let's get back to these walls built to separate and generate hate. Built to execute and induce waste. So I write from a place of pure base, all the five elements put together to produce faith. See, I write for men, women, and children. Anyone who felt alone. I write for the bones buried in the country I call home. I write for you, the listener. Take a step back and imagine the bigger picture. Because I write the real, so feel me.
Liam Cochrane with that report. And you've been listening to a Radio Current Affairs documentary.